This is With Dignity, the story of Casey House, episode 3. Princess Diana was coming to Casey House. A longtime supporter and advocate of the PWA community, Princess Diana had been visiting hospices and hospitals around the UK and the United States, and Casey House was her next stop. While nurses and staff had a bit more warning of her visit, out of worry that residents and their families would get their hopes up only to not make it to the day, they were only told 7 days in advance. Nancy Rowe Lussier's dad was a client at Casey House at that time, and I got the chance to ask her all about what that day was like. If you've seen my play Casey and Diana, you'll know that Princess Diana's visit is a moment I've thought a lot about. Nancy was visiting with her dad right after he got the news, so he got to tell her personally that they were going to meet a princess.
He immediately asked if I would want to come, and of course, yes, you know, I want to be there and thank you, and it would be fabulous to be there. And then there was still one spot, so he asked my sister to join. We grew up loving the royal family, and I had scrapbooks of Princess Diana, of her wedding, and I was so sad because I just didn't have enough time to try and dig them out.
Do you remember who told your dad, like how he found out?
So I believe it was Judy, who was his first social worker, who told him that Diana was coming. And she was very excited too. She let my dad tell me, but then as soon as he had told me, then she came in and we just couldn't stop talking about how exciting it was. And of course, then we started talking about what would the day be like and what would we wear and what will she be like?
What will we wear? That would be my first thing. What does one wear? Can you talk to me about the prep?
So we did have some guidelines and some instructions, you know, just simple things like let Princess Diana have an opportunity to speak to my dad. We were told to curtsy. We weren't shaking hands, and how to address her as a princess.
Yeah, so talk me through that day a bit. So you woke up that morning and went, I'm about to meet a princess.
Yeah. I was so elated. I remember, you know, the day before getting my dress ready and making sure we wouldn't be late because you had to be through the doors at a certain time. We were part of the bustle that was going on at Casey House. So we got to meet June Colwood. We spoke with Jane and different board members, and everybody was excited. And I do remember my dad had been asked to do a presentation on behalf of Casey House to Princess Diana. And he decided he wasn't able to do that. So we had a lot of conversations leading up to her visit about this. And he felt he wasn't ready to do that because then his picture would be out in the public and he wanted to remain private. Of course, I thought, you can do this. You know, it's okay. You know, you don't worry about what anybody else is thinking and we're here with you. And really tried to encourage him to change his mind. And he stayed with that decision. But also him wanting to be private meant we had to be very private too. And I remember this so well because I wanted to go on the porch so badly and be out with the crowd and to be on this side of Princess Diana's visit and just see all the excitement in the crowd of people that were there. And my dad did not want us to go out. So we were able to look at the side of the curtains out of the crowds, but he didn't want us to be out fully. And I found that hard.
Of course. Yeah. A moment that plays wildly in my imagination is the moment between like hearing the cheer of her mm-hmm. arriving and then knowing she's come inside. Yeah. And now you're just sitting in your in the room waiting. Like, I have played through that moment. What was that like?
Oh, you're tingling.
I know, right? Tell me about the moment of waiting and then her walking in the door.
Yeah, you're just tingling with anticipation and the waiting and the cheers. Like, the sound of the crowd when she pulled up and you could just hear the screaming and the cheering. And you think, oh my gosh, this is actually happening. Because you can't, you can't accept it really until you actually hear and you start to realize that she is. And I think knowing she's in the hallway, she had made it to the second level. And then knowing that she's two doors down and she's coming. And you're just sitting thinking, oh my gosh, like, what are we going to say? What's going to happen? And it was awe-inspiring when she came in the room. You just can't believe that she's sitting there. It's hard to take it all in because you're seeing her and she's present and she's beautiful and so caring. And just put us at ease and just spoke to my dad directly about his care and about who he was. And it's just something I'll never forget. It was thrilling.
After Diana's visit, some of the patients and many of the staff experienced what they later called the Diana effect, a boost in morale and health in Diana's wake.
I think the visit brought acceptance for him. He felt a lot of shame, and which is very sad. And so when she came to visit, it just gave him a feeling of being accepted and that things are okay. You know, it really gave us a boost to say, Princess Diana's here, and let's set aside all this stigma. Let's set aside all the fear and the worry. And I know for my dad, his spirit really improved. So the Diana effect for him personally was he felt better and his health improved. And I can honestly say it really changed our path and our journey because it really gave us a positive experience that we could share. And then, of course, what happened is he started to decline again. And it was hard watching, you know, when he had been able to get up and walk and we could go for walks. And then, of course, to watch the decline happen. But the care was, I think, beyond compare of where we would have got anywhere. He still, right up to the end, was contributing to his decisions up until the point where he wasn't able to, until he was too sick.
Casey House gave him that autonomy, the dignity to make his own decisions from his first day to the visit from Diana to his last day. Nancy's dad, Ken, passed away at Casey House in 1992. Nancy describes that time at Casey House as a gift. She got to know her dad a bit better. And she got to know her dad's partner.
We've had a lifelong friendship with him since my dad passed away. We don't see each other all the time, but it's a lasting friendship. And we always think it's really too bad that my dad wasn't able to share in that. But then we think it's okay because we've got this now, right? We have this friendship. And so that was the one positive that came out of all of this. We had 10 months with him at Casey House, and it allowed us to have an ending with him. And it brought a lot of peace at a very difficult, difficult time.
In 2022, on the 30th anniversary of her dad's passing, Nancy reconnected with Casey House. She wanted to go for a visit and bring her kids so that they might know a bit more about what she went through with her dad. She reached out to CEO Joanne Simons to tour the new facility and was immediately invited to come visit.
We walked through the doors and I knew that that human spirit was there and that the caring was still there. And we went into the common area and my dad's quilt was hanging on the wall. And I can tell you that moment, it was so powerful for me and so meaningful. And at that moment, I knew that all of the care that happened at Casey House when my dad was living had been transferred over to the new hospital.
So there's this really beautiful practice. Each year, a group of volunteer quilters sew a quilt to memorialize those who passed away in Casey House's care.
And that was an intentional gift to me, to have that there. And it meant so much.
In the 1992 quilt, you can see the name Kenneth R. on a square in the bottom right. One of 64 names on that year's quilt.
when we left there, the kids had such a whole different perspective and a better understanding. And so my kids are able to say, oh, at my age, this is what you were doing. And I just feel like part of the history.
You're part of the fabric.
Part of the fabric. That's how I feel. That's a hard feeling to beat. With sharing this with my kids, I do ask of them, how do you make a difference? I guess that's really what my reacquainting with Casey House has meant to me, is really about how can I make a difference from here?
6 years after her visit to Casey House, Princess Diana died. Here's Bree Fitzgerald remembering the way her grandmother June described that day.
I was with her when Diana died, and that is a conversation I'll never forget. We were at home and we got that news, and she just went right through the day again that she spent at Casey House. Just, she was so tickled to meet her. I mean, she was really giddy. June had this capacity to be like a little child a lot, just that kind of joy you don't often get in grown-ups. They're just still just so excited about the possibilities in pretty much any opportunity, I think is the way that June pretty much handled those things. I mean, from my perspective, I remember listening to her thinking, like, you're very similar women. I mean, of course you got along. Of course she would come to Casey House, because that's exactly the same sort of thing. That she would build things the same way you did. They're not dissimilar. They're both women who weren't paying much attention to the guidebook. They both had this enormous capacity to just reach right into the person that they were talking to and find connection, and also not just connection, but somehow feed in some feeling of everything's going to be okay. Like, you can keep going. You can hold whatever it is lightly, and that you're definitely not alone.
The Diana visit was a moment that stayed with June. It stays with me. It was a moment where Diana took her sizable influence and power and directed that spotlight onto an issue that she thought was important. I think you could say June did the same thing with her influence. In the months following Diana's visit in 1991, the Diana effect wore off, but Casey House continued to serve their community, and the need was no less urgent. AIDS deaths in Canada steadily rose in the early 1990s. Michael Oscars and the DQ team stepped in once again to help fundraise.
And they talked me into it to do it again in 92. And the first two, we lip-synced. When I say we, the cast lip-synced to a song called We're Going to Make It After All, which is an old pop song from the 60s. Well, the closing number always ended up with the cast taking their wigs off and coming in the Casey House t-shirt and lining up and singing and then taking their curtain call with everybody on stage. It was very effective. It moved everybody.
But for DQ92, Michael had a new idea.
There was a wonderful guy called Alan Coffin, unfortunate name, but there we have it. A charming, really nice guy, and he was a choir master. And I don't know why, I just said one day, why didn't you come to rehearsal? And I'd just be curious if you could group everybody, sort them out, you triage them, who can sing high, who can sing low, just see the sound you can get out of them. And he did. And he very quickly put them all together, and the sound was amazing, just amazing. So I thought, okay. So we started with a song called Somewhere Out There, and we'd had a miserable time putting it together, because for some reason, the kids just, didn't get it. June came, and suddenly I said, June Corwood, founder of Casey House. Everybody snapped to attention. And then when we did the run-through, we were running part of the last act to the end, and came the live song. And I thought, like RuPaul would say, and don't fuck it up. But they all snapped to attention, and they sang it perfectly. And she was like gobsmacked because she didn't know that there would be a live number. And then I realized the synergy between her and the effect she had on everybody was they got it together. In that big somewhere out there. And that, ladies and gentlemen, we have a show. It spurred a lot of donations, a lot of bequests, and more importantly, it raised the consciousness.
Michael was recruited to lead another DQ in 1995. That year, they sang live again. This time, it was If We Only Have Love.
So many there, not with us. Literally that entire section. You know, it's funny because just like you can't capture the lightning in a bottle, you know, it's we tried several times, I think, to do DQ get-togethers, but the thing that's so difficult is, and I wasn't kidding, when you look at the cast and I'm thinking, oh God, that entire segment, they're gone. So you can't. And, you know, nearly 40 years later, it stays with you. It meant the world for them to do it. They were treated like professionals. There was a lot of the kids in the show were proud that they were in the show. And they saw the validation every night at the curtain call. People who barely knew them, who would wait for them and say, you were fabulous, you were so good. Who knew you could do that? Blah, 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 blah. So it was very reaffirming.
And just to be seen at that point.
And they were seen. And that was the main thing.
One of June's big aspirations right from the beginning of Casey House was to serve more patients than their 13 beds could accommodate. And in 1993, they launched it, their community care program. Casey House would provide a social worker and nurse to help clients access healthcare and build care plans that worked for them. Guy Bethel and his partner Sid received support from that community care program. But let's start with their love story.
There's a line from a Pet Shop Boys song, and it was how Sid and I regarded our relationship. There's a line in the song, just when you least expect it. Just what you least expect. Just what you least expect. That was Sid and my meeting. It's a Saturday afternoon. I popped into a bar to get a beer in a city I was in for the first day on business that I didn't know. And I met the man of my dreams. Sid had the most outgoing, positive personality. He just radiated it. Oh, man. The guy was larger than life. You know, whenever I tell people about Sid and the fact that he passed, and then it was, oh, I'm so sorry. And it's like, you don't have to apologize. Sure, you know, what we had to deal with was a crappy challenge. But I had 12 years of what some people don't get to experience in a lifetime. We were very different, and we knew we were stronger as a partnership, and we never saw each other as a threat. We only relished what each of us brought and shared in the relationship. We could say, I love you, with just a look. He was just a diehard optimist. He would classify anything as an adventure, and then it became a good thing, whatever that was.
They fell in love, moved in together, started a life. But in 1995, Sid got sick.
Sid wanted to live life as normally as possible. We knew what the most likely eventual outcome was going to be, and he wanted to live life as normally as possible, and I did everything in my power to make that happen. You know, Sid was taking so many medications. I actually made up a table. He was on 22 medications at one time. Which doctor prescribed it, what it was to treat, when he took it, the dosage, if there were any interactions. And I printed off a sheet every time we went to Emerge, because they would always ask you, what medications are you on? And I'd say, here you go. They loved me for that.
Guy put his everything into becoming his full-time caregiver. But at a certain point, he needed support. And Casey House was there. They became clients through the community care program.
Judy was a social worker, and Sally was our nursing coordinator. They were perfectly suited to the task. They were engaging, caring, knowledgeable, just loving people, accepting, supportive. Like Sid's family were very well intentioned, but they could be overwhelming. And, you know, Judy was the icing on the cake for helping us sort of channel their energy in a way they could support the brother they loved and cared about so much. And, you know, just made everybody feel welcome and provided an opportunity for them to participate in a meaningful way.
They helped Guy and Sid navigate the healthcare system and were there as Sid got sicker and sicker.
The night Sid passed, it was January the 16th, 2000. It was a Sunday. It was late in the evening. It was snowing a hell of a lot more heavily than it is today. And it was probably like minus 25, minus 30. And Sid and I had talked whether today was the day. And our neighbor helped me get Sid out to the car. And I drove him to Toronto General Hospital. But before I left, I called Sally and I said, this is where we're at. And, you know, we don't know if this is the final trip or not. And she said, don't worry, I'll call TGH and let them know you're coming and, you know, what the circumstances are. And then she called me back and said, yeah, they're prepared for you. And then we went to the hospital and Slid slowly passed away. We were in Emerge at TGH, as we've been many times before. And by that time, he had a do not resuscitate order. It was his time, and I was holding his hand and talking to him, and his closest friend, Leslie, joined me at the hospital, and he passed away with the pair of us there, and we went home, and three of our other closest friends, Paul and Douglas, were there. By then, it was midnight, and then Judy and Sally showed up and sat with us chatting about Sid. The guy left a freaking big impact. Like, he was such a larger-than-life character. And the seven of us by then sat chatting for the best part of 3 or 4 hours until the wee hours of the morning. Dealing with a terminal illness is crappy in any circumstance, but one small saving grace is it gives you the opportunity to leave nothing unsaid. And that was certainly the case between Sid and I. You know, he was able to tell me everything he wanted, funeral arrangements, he wanted two memorials, one in Guelph and one in Toronto. And he wanted us each to pick a piece of music for each other, which we did, and we shared that so he knew what it was. And in Guelph, the closing piece of music, we didn't say what it was in the program. It said something that projects what Sid believed. And it was the Always Look on the Bright Side of Life from Monty Python's Life. That gives you an insight into what kind of guy he was. So, you know, people were laughing and crying, and he chose that.
Because of Guy and because of Casey House's care, Sid was able to make choices for himself until the very end.
I stood on Casey House's shoulders in taking care of Sid. Everything I did was because they had my back.
And Sid's memory lives on at Casey House. Guy himself stayed connected to the organization and became a volunteer.
I never knew that Sid's name was in the 2000 quilt, and the CEO at the time, she brought it out, and I saw it, and obviously it had a very deep emotional effect to see his name in there. And it was some years after. They're very powerful. They're very powerful and very beautiful.
Volunteers are still making quilts for Casey House, though thankfully there are less and less squares sewn as the years go by. Casey House saw a lot of changes over the following years as the landscape of HIV and AIDS shifted, and they were about to see another big change in the years to come. The passing of June Callwood. That's next time.